Introduce Joel W. from Avondale, Arizona as our speaker. Let's give it up.
Joel, I'm an addict.
Hi, Joel.
I'm I've been waiting a little while for this. I missed you guys a lot. And I woke up this morning, man, I got to put on my NAJs, man, and I got to pull my little Denmark lanyard out of the cupboard and get all conventioned up and ready to rock and roll, and man, my spirit's on fire for recovery right now. I'm excited to be clean, and I'm excited to be here, man. And me and my friend Rich, man, we made a commitment a couple months back that we were going to stay and keep our recovery in motion, and we were going to do some things in order to, you know, not get caught up in the isolation and just that chaos that's been kind of going on around us, and recommit to this way of life, man, because it's been challenging for me, and I've missed you guys so much. And so I'm excited to be here. I'm excited that God seemed fit to put me in this position to be able to be of service today. I got to be honest with you, like, I get jammed up, and I suffer from the disease of separation, and a lot of times it tells me, like, Joel, you don't belong at the podium. It tells me that, hey, somebody else is better, like, maybe they got you there by mistake, and I start to think you don't have anything to offer, and I settle in, and I connect with God, and I'm reminded that, like, God didn't put me in this position for no reason. Like, I'm on an assignment today, and I don't put limitations on what God has in store for my life, and so I'm centered, and I'm here, and I'm grateful, and I'm excited to be clean, man. I'm so excited. Make some noise if you're excited to be clean. Excited to be here, man. If you're new, welcome. I'm a little bit biased, but I believe this is the greatest show on earth, for real. And our diversity is our strength, and there's so many people from so many different backgrounds here, and we come together and we fellowship and we love on each other, and I know I'm not for everybody, but there's somebody here for you, and so if you're new, just keep coming. Don't let the color of someone's skin or their sexual preference or where they're from or how long they've been clean or whatever to separate you from this way of life. Because when I came in, like, I was always looking at the differences, you know, if that guy hadn't been locked up, then I couldn't connect with him. And if he didn't come from some small, you know, predominantly white community, I couldn't connect with him. And what I realized the longer I've stayed here is that, like, at some point in time in my recovery, I'm going to need each and every one of you in some capacity. And I got to stay open-minded and willing to soak in what you have to offer. And we all have so much to offer, regardless of your clean time. Like, it doesn't matter. Is David in here? David from Sierra Vista? I met this cat in the elevator, man. He's never been to a convention before. And I miss newcomers so much. That's what I'm struggling with about this whole, you know, this social distancing and no convention stuff, because I love newcomers. Like, I have a love affair with newcomers. I love to snatch them up at the beginning of convention, drag them around, feed them a lot of food, you know, give them all the literature, put T-shirts on them, and send them back to their area. You know what I'm saying? They're like, ah! You know, I'm just on fire. Like, I miss that, you know? And I met this guy in the elevator named David, man, and I said, David, you ever been to a convention before? He's like, no, this is my first one. And he got all excited, and so I'm thankful for the committee for stepping out in some faith and working through some of the challenges to make this thing happen, man. So if you're on the committee, thank you guys, man. Let's give the committee a round of applause. I know it's been challenging, man. There's been a lot of obstacles to overcome. But what I've realized through some of my 11-step work over the past few months is that, like, the disease wants me dead a whole lot more than this pandemic stuff does. And so, like, I've had to recreate my recovery and do things differently and connect in different ways and think outside the box. And so for those of you who are on this committee that thought outside the box to do what you need to do to make this happen, thank you. Thank you. And if you've held down a Zoom meeting this whole entire time, thank you for providing an atmosphere of recovery where we can go and fellowship and get connected and hear the life-saving message that an addict, any addict, can stop using, lose the desire to use, and find a new way to live. Man, like, the message has been carried on Zoom, and I'm thankful for that. I'm thankful for those that have jumped through the obstacles and held down in-person meetings throughout this, whether it's politically correct or not. Like, thank you guys, because see, I know that the disease wants to use these trying times right now to kill me, to kill all of us. It wants to come in and convince us, you know what I'm saying, like. We don't need to go out and do what we need to do, and we'll be okay. We can stay clean on last year's recovery and the last set of steps, And what I know to be true, man, is if I'm trying to stay clean on year one, two, or three recovery, I'm going to die in year 12. I don't doubt that one bit. And so I got to stay engaged in this process. You know, when it talks about in literature that complacency is the enemy of those with time. Complacency is the enemy of everyone. 30 days or 30 years, man, if we get complacent, the disease will kill us. And this whole, the last few months has been an opportunity to kind of get complacent. And I got to be honest with you, like, I've been a little bit complacent in my recovery because it's been challenging because things haven't been the normal. Like, everything I knew when I was so involved in the things that I was doing has been ripped off underneath of me. Conventions canceled. You know, I didn't get to celebrate this year. If you didn't get to celebrate here this year, by chance, raise your hand. You know what I mean? Like, if you didn't get to pick up a key tag or a coin because your home group was shut down, let's celebrate right now. Give yourself a round of applause if you didn't get to celebrate this year. Real. And I got sucked up about that, you know what I mean? Like, I was like, man, you know, for the 11 years prior, like, my birthday would come, and I'd go to my home group, and I'd get a coin from my sponsor, and I'd, you know what I'm saying, some of my home group members would validate me and tell me how cool I was, and I'd walk away, like, on fire to get another year clean, and I didn't get to do that this year. But see, the disease wants me to get jammed up on that and get resentful and live in this triangle of self-obsession, you know what I'm saying? And just get angry about whatever and resentful about these different things. And I want to say F COVID and F this and I'm going to whatever. And the reality is, man, like I've been given these tools through the 12 steps in Narcotics Anonymous to practice these principles in all my affairs. And if I choose to, I can practice them in the midst of this storm we're living in right now. And so I've recommitted, and over the last couple months I've been dialed in, and I got this sense of peace over me, and I'm not living in the chaos and unmanageability anymore, and I like to hike a lot. I seem to connect with the God of my understanding when I'm out in the middle of nowhere, and there's these they're called the Verado Steps, and they're down in the valley, in Buckeye, Arizona, and there's 340 steps. And those of you who get out and about, you know, you may connect to this and you may not. I'm not exactly sure, but there's this little set of steps, and God is so beautiful, man. The first part of this thing, there's 12 steps, right? 12 steps. And there's this little platform, and then you go down, and then after that, it's like 328 more steps up the side of this mountain, right? And so I go out there, I'm like, shit, this is... When it cooled down in the valley, you know what I mean, I start to get out and I'm get back in shape again because I've developed a relationship with the fridge during the pandemic. I'm not going to lie. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's been my go-to and I've been actively using regularly. So I put on a little bit of weight. And so I go back out the first time to, you know what I'm saying, start to get back in shape. And I'm like, damn. But I take off and I climb. And I automatically connect with what's around me. And so I climb these first set of 12 steps and I count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And I stop on this platform, and God just touches my heart and says, man, like, you know, this is a 12-step process, Joel. And those first set of 12 steps that you know what I'm saying, you work the first time through the steps, give you the opportunity to continue this 12-step process for the rest of your life. And so one step at a time, I navigated up those other 328 steps over and over and over again. And I started to do some math, you know what I'm saying? I'm thinking, okay, if I do 12 steps, I do a set of steps for 29 years, it'll be about 328 steps, you know what I'm saying? So, like, that's a pretty good, you know what I'm saying? I'm thinking about this whole thing. And then it clicked to me, like, it's really not about that. It's about continuing to work these steps and apply these steps in all my affairs all the time. Like, that first set of steps gave me the tools and the ability to apply this stuff to my life. And so I have these set of tools now. And really, it's, you know, I continue to work steps out of the book, but life is really about continuing to apply these steps. And so I kind of want to share about that today, about how I've been given these tools in my first set of steps to continue to walk through life and deal with life on life's terms no matter what. You know, I have not done this thing perfectly. I guarantee that. But I've stayed perfectly clean for 12 and, you know what I'm saying, years and some change. Right. And yeah, thank you guys, man. And it's just been mind-blowing to navigate through life and experience the blessings and walk through the storms and meet people. And I was talking to my friend Dougie, man, about how like I miss getting out and meeting people. Like, I've committed my life to, like, to making memories and meeting people and going to conventions and connecting with others and feeling the love, because I didn't have that before I got clean. And Narcotics Anonymous has given me the opportunity to get out and meet people and connect and develop these relationships and love on you so you can love on me. And when I pour love into you, I receive it in return, and my spirit's just been touched. But it's been difficult because, like I said, this thing is, you know, things are different now. But I was thinking a lot about when I first got here. Is there any newcomers in the room right now? Anybody new? Within 30 days? A bunch of old timers up in here, huh? That's cool. The pressure's on then. Shit. Pressure's on. But I was thinking about back when I you know what I'm saying, before I got here. And when the holidays come, I really reflect on the holidays, because for me, like, I was a mess the holidays. Like, I was the guy who would destroy every good thing that was going on around me, right? And so always leading up to any holiday, I think about what it was like, you know, 12 years ago and some change, or 13 years ago around this time. And man, I was living in this little tiny box that I couldn't get out of. I was living in that place that it talks about in the literature of isolation and degradation and desperation, and I wanted to flip and die, man. But I would go to these functions because my family wanted me to go, and I'd go through the motions, and I'd nod out somewhere. I'd just destroy everything. And it's like when you threw Joel W. into a pool of water back in active addiction, man, this ripple effect of chaos and destruction went out around me, and everything that was around me was destroyed. And I pissed away a lot of good things and a lot of good relationships in active addiction. And I think back to all the opportunities I had to reach the end of the road, right? And I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time back there, but there's a couple things just, you know, that I think are important that I need to touch on. And because I was given that opportunity, you know, the choice to, like, choose the other side of the oar. And it talks about we recover, and that there's some pieces of the literature really speak to me, and that's one of them. And it says we can either go on to the bitter ends, jails, institutions, or death, or find a new way to live. And that word or gave me a choice. And see, many times before I found Narcotics Anonymous, I had that choice. Where, like, I ended up with some serious, serious consequences, and I could have chose a different path. I could have chose to reach out for help and humble myself, but I chose not to. And I went to the penitentiary when I was 17 years old. I was tried as an adult. And it destroyed everything I knew about morals and beliefs. And I was given this set of skills and these tools, and I was given this information from misinformed people, and it became about prison politics and a bunch of nonsense, and it just really distorted my way of thinking. And so when I was released, man, I wanted to be a convict, and I wanted to be a lot of things. Like, I don't know about you guys, but I was a mask-wearing machine, and I never really wanted to know exactly what I had going on inside. And from a young age, I was just so insecure inside, and there was so much lack of self-worth going on that I painted a picture of a whole bunch of different people, you know. And I could go to prison and I could be Big Whitey, and I'd leave prison, I'd want to be a black gangster rapper. And picture this, guys, like, for real. Like, I have this purple velour jumpsuit and this derby hat on, a little purple bandana, and I'd have the walk going on, you know what I mean? And I'd hang out with this crew, and then when I needed to, like, change to be something else, I would put on some other mask and go be somebody else. I, you know, put on my little sweater vest, and I could be a prep, and I'd hang out and, you know, see all this cool stuff, like I was from the Valley or whatever, you know, just some nonsense. And I was good at that. But what never changed was how I felt inside. That never changed. There was that huge hole inside of me, and I was always searching for something, for something. And that search always took me to this, to negative behaviors. And when that substance wouldn't work, I'd switch to some other substance. And when that substance quit working, I'd switch to something else. And I'd go back to this tough guy, routine. And I'd impose my will on people and beat people up. And so I was always dealing with all these, you know, negative consequences. But never once did I think that, like, I might be responsible for any of that stuff. It was always the judge's fault. And it was always her fault. And it was always my parents' fault. It was never my fault. And through my inability to accept personal responsibilities, I was actually creating my own problems. And I didn't know that. You know what I mean? I didn't know that. It was always somebody else's fault. I tried a geographical change once. I don't know if you guys have ever attempted that before, but, you know, you move from one location to the other, and life's going to be different. I tried that once. I moved to Alaska. And the wild thing was, is Joel showed up in Alaska and nothing was different. The only thing that was different was the drugs were more expensive and the town was smaller. And so when you're, you know what I'm saying, when you're ignorant asshole running around making a fool of yourself, you really stand out. And it wasn't long before I was back in the same, you know, madness I was in Washington. And I was arrested, naked, in Alaska. And I was just like, fuck, man, how'd this happen again, you know? But I wasn't willing to accept any responsibility. And I, you know, they gave me my bail money back, and I bailed out of Alaska and went back to Washington and did another geographical change. Within a couple weeks, man, I burnt my parents' house down and almost killed my entire family. knotted out with a torch, man, kicked it over, and by the grace of a loving higher power, my pops was able to, you know, wake up and heard me thrash around and drag me out of the house. And fortunately, no one was hurt. And I was able to be given another opportunity, you know what I'm saying, to choose the end of the road. You would think, like, you know, arrested in Alaska naked, burning a parent's house down, penitentiary at 17. Like, there's all these opportunities for me to be like, hey, man, enough is enough. Like, let's do something different. But I really just wanted to, like, successfully use. Like, I wanted to work for the union and successfully use because that's what my family did. But I could never successfully do anything that revolved around using. Like, I didn't have a hustle, you know what I mean? I was none of that stuff. And so in about 2006 or so, man, my Uncle Bob shows up at my house. And he's got a bunch of clean time. And he's really well-to-do. And he calls and he says he's coming down. And so I'm ready to, like, game him, right? I'm like, all right, he's going to get down here. I'm going to tell him all sorts of cool stuff. I'm going to hustle some money out of him. I'm going to get a fat sack. I'm going to flip it a few times. I'm going to get back to baller status. I'm going to be rolling again. And he shows up, and he's like, hey, Joel, you want to go to a meeting? I'm like, what the fuck's a meeting, man? So I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to buy into the meeting. I'll go to the meeting. After the meeting, you know what I'm saying, I'll get some money out of him. So we go to the meeting, four or five people in the meeting, a candlelight meeting, Friday night New Life meeting in back in Washington State, and there was four or five people there, and I remember nothing about the meeting, but at the end of the meeting, they told me I was the most important person in the meeting. And I thought, no way, not me. Like, I remember that moment thinking, not me, man. I was spun to the gills. I've been up for days, and I was like, not me. Like, I could not wrap my head around the fact that I was the most important person in the meeting. And so if you're new and you're having a hard time with that, or you've been here for a while and you're having a hard time, you know what I'm saying, you're not the most important person in the meeting. What I know to be true now is that, you know, we're all just as important as anybody else. The reason why the emphasis on the newcomer is that we need you guys. Like, you know what I'm saying? We need each and every member of Narcotics Anonymous to be here and be present, engaged in this process, because I can't keep what I have unless I give it away. And like I said, I have this love affair with newcomers that for whatever reason, I'm just compelled to give it to newcomers. And I wish I could just shove it down newcomers' throat, but I can't do that. But I want them to feel what I felt at that very first meeting. Just the feeling. Like, I didn't know anything. That stuff on the wall didn't make sense. The prayer stuff scared the crap out of me. I didn't embrace. I held hands like way far away. I didn't even want to like get close, but there was a sense of love there. And we left that meeting. They gave me a phone list. And so when we're leaving, you know, I start game my Uncle Bob. Like, oh yeah, I love that meeting. It was so good. I can't wait to go back. And I'm telling him all this stuff that he wants to hear, because I, you know what I'm saying, I could game some stuff. And we get back to the house, and he says, here you go, Joel. And so I think he's going to break off a few hundreds or something. And he breaks off a basic text in Narcotics Anonymous. He knew what I needed. I thought I knew what I needed, but he knew what I really needed. A couple weeks later, man, my car got broken into. And basic text got stolen. I vividly remember saying, I'm obviously not meant to be a member of Narcotics Anonymous. And I continued down that dark, desperate road of active addiction, just creating all this wreckage. In 2006, my daughter was born. I thought that having a child was going to change things. And it was shortly after she was born that I traded her in for a sack of dope. I remember I was supposed to be at home, like, putting together the crib while she was in the hospital. I was out getting one more. And when her mom and her got home, like, the crib wasn't put together. And I was a hot mess. And a couple days later, I convinced her mom to start using because it made me feel better about myself. And there we were, actively using with a newborn baby, dragging her around the streets, 2-3 in the morning at the dope house. Her mom went out one night. I remember this so vividly. Like, her mom went out one night, and I didn't have any way to get a hold of her because I had lost my hustle, didn't have a phone, and I carried my daughter 2-3 in the morning in Washington in the rain to a payphone at some, you know what I'm saying, dope Minute Mart on the corner, and called her mom, and the lady was like, "Are you okay, sir?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'm fine." And I really thought that I was okay. I really thought that, like, that was okay. Shortly thereafter, man, God intervened on my life. God said, no more, Joel. Like, if you're not willing to pick the end of the road, we're going to pick it for you. And I got arrested one last time. And no longer were my parents going to bail me out. No longer was my lawyer going to go to bat for me. And I ended up at another meeting in Narcotics Anonymous on day six of being in the county jail. And I remember it so vividly. And whenever I'm in a room like this, I always think about the back right corner, because that's where I was sat at in that meeting. And they shared, and the guy who was sharing had 3 years clean. And I'd done time with him. I'd used with him. And he was going into the jail and leaving in an hour. And I was like, holy shit, man. Like, that's amazing to me. Because at that time, I wasn't leaving. Like, I had a prison sentence with no release date, my third strike. And I'm thinking, man, like, it just blew my mind. But I listened to what was said, and I didn't hear anything, but I felt it. I felt the love, and I felt the hope, and it touched my heart, and I started to cry. And then they had asked if anybody had any questions. And I raised my hand real quick. And I went on this glorification, rationalization, justification about why I was there and how I was going to do things different. I took the meeting hostage. You know that guy. If you do H&I, the guy, when you open up for questions and he's yeah. all of a sudden he's, you know, pontificates how great his recovery is on day two. You know what I mean? And that was me. And just held it hostage, man. And they let me go for a little bit, which was cool. And I got some stuff off. And after the meeting, the guy came up and he hugged on me and loved me. And he told me, he said, Joel, just keep coming back. And I believe at that very moment, before I even knew what surrender was all about, because I didn't come into the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. I didn't know anything about surrender. You know, I didn't know about you know, raising my hand and asking for help or reaching out and asking for help. That wasn't part of my DNA. That was not something that you did, you know what I'm saying, in the streets or in the prison cell or in the prison yard. That wasn't something you did. But I believe at that moment in time, when I said I'm Joel, an addict, and that God seen what was going on and felt something in my spirit, then I believe at that very moment that I surrendered to the disease of addiction and started to allow God to help me to live with it, like whether I knew that or not. And things started to unfold for me, and I ended up getting a prison sentence with a release date, and I ended up going to institutions where Narcotics Anonymous was alive and well, and I'm so thankful for H&I. H&I has impacted my life on so many levels. You know, those guys came in week after week after week after week, no matter what. Thanksgiving, our home group met on Thursday night. My first home group ever was Birds of a Feather meeting at Narcotics Anonymous. It still meets in a correctional facility in Washington State. And those guys came in every week. And I wondered why. Like, why do you keep coming? And I realize now, they kept coming because by giving it to me, they were getting so much in return. And they gave me so much. I told Joel, the guy who came in, man, he just celebrated 50 years clean in June. But he told me, he said, I'm like, Joel, man, I owe you my life. He said, no, Joel, you owe Narcotics Anonymous your life. And so that's why I keep coming. That's why I've invested my whole entire life into Narcotics Anonymous, because Narcotics Anonymous saved my life. Like, that cat came in week after week after week. And they wouldn't even share sometimes. They told us about how to live inside the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous and gave us a foundation to be able to live out here, and taught us about sponsorship, and taught us about step work, and taught us about, you know, carrying this message, and taught us about service work. And that fellowship blew up inside of the institution. And we had recovery banquets, and we had speaker meetings, and we broke all sorts of traditions, I haven't shared this in a long time, but we put a presentation together for the institution. We wanted to have this recovery banquet, but they only would allow us to have it if we included all the fellowships. And at that time, we really didn't know, you know what I'm saying? And Joel and Jim kind of let us run with it, but we had put this together, recovery banquet. We made a flyer, and it had multiple fellowships logos on the front, and he opened it up and had our full names with our clean dates inside of there, and we were quoting literature, and we had some fancy stuff out of the basic text, and then we quoted it, the basic big book. Swear to God, guys. And I still got the little flyer, man. It's beautiful. But the cool thing is, man, that recovery banquet's still going on, and it's a Narcotics Anonymous recovery banquet now, and they're practicing traditions, and the guys are on fire in there, and I was like a foundational piece of that, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm sure that back in 53, like, Jimmy wasn't doing things perfect, and there was all sorts of stuff going on, and we're learning, and I was able to learn and grow inside the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous while I was there. And when I left that institution, man, I traded in my six-digit DOC number for a six-digit clean date, and that's the most important number of my life. Like, 721 of 08 is the most important number of my life. Like, I value that thing like it's gold, man. I do not want to lose it. And so I keep coming, even in the midst of a pandemic, even when I don't want to come, even when my life is so beautiful that my disease tells me I don't need to come, I keep coming, and I keep serving. And I'm just roll with the punches, I'm supposed to share tomorrow morning, but God says share at 1 o'clock this afternoon in the men's wrap and just show up, because I need you guys, and I need this in order to stay clean. When I left, I was on fire for Narcotics Anonymous. Like, I'm an ambitious addict. And those guys would come in and make, announcements about things that were happening, conventions here and events here and men's things here and this and that. And they introduced the World Convention in San Diego. And I said, I'm going to that thing, man. Like, and I had $105 on my books. I'd saved up $105 over 2 years. I had a 42 cents an hour job. I was working outside the camp, and I was balling. Like, I'd saved up a little bit of money, and I spent 3/4 of it to register for the World Convention, with no clue how I was going to get there. And 31 days after I got out of the penitentiary. But God, like, once I turned my will over and I started really living 11 step, and I was always, you know what I'm saying, in prayer and meditation, like, God was doing things for me that I couldn't do for myself. Like, I know there was no way, shape, or form that Joel W. was going to get his ass to that convention. But when Joel W. has the love of the fellowship and a loving higher power in his life, Joel W. can go anywhere. And God got me there, you know what I'm saying? So 31 days out of the penitentiary, on parole, I'm not a white collar criminal, fellas. Like, I don't have a rap sheet that's, like, you know what I'm saying, very presentable. I got some crimes on my record that are somewhat serious. But God doesn't care about all that stuff. God cares about what's going on in my heart. And God knew that I was lined up with His will, and that, like, I was on this path of recovery, and knew that I needed to go experience something that was gonna blow my mind. And when I showed up there, I was like, holy shit. 15,000 addicts from all over the world, loving on each other and hugging on each other. And I just had this spiritual experience that I never experienced before. And I looked around and I was touched by the love of the fellowship. And when I saw people from other countries, I just, I think it was Friday night that they had this cultural thing happened, you know, that they had some members from, I think it was Japan or something, that was the Friday night thing, maybe a Thursday night, I don't know. They came and banged on their drums, and this just this sense of, like, this atmosphere of recovery was on fire, and I felt so much love and so much hope. I was so excited for recovery that I was like, I'm never going to use again. Never. Like, I just felt it. And I had 3 years clean in the countdown. This is wild, man. The countdown happened, and I was waiting for a long time because there was a lot of you old timers there, man. I was like, you know, I mean, and people were jumping up and yelling and screaming, and flags from other countries are going, and I'm like, just so caught up in the moment. And as it got closer to me, like, more and more people started to stand up, right? Because the, you know what I'm saying, our fellowships, you know what I'm saying, we've been around a while, but there's, you know what I'm saying, a lot more younger members than there is older members. And I remember it getting down to me, and more people started sitting up, and that like sense of excitement came over me, and I started to get the chills, and I jumped up on my chair and I waved my hand, and I was excited, man, and the chair buckled out from underneath me, almost went down. And I knew, like, the atmosphere recovery that happens at events like this, it's stuff that keeps us coming back. It has kept me coming back. Like, that love and that connection has kept me coming back. And so that's why I'm willing to, like, get outside of myself and be a little uncomfortable and come here and fellowship, because I need this. I need this so, so much. You know, and I'll be honest with you guys. Like, I was a little bit distracted at that convention by newcomers and short skirts and all that stuff. I really was. And I went to the dance and, you know, a couple different, like, I went out on the dance floor, and I hadn't been around females for a long time, and this chick tried to back her thing up on me, and I really wanted to engage, but I couldn't. I ran out of the dance, man. I was like, it was too much for me, because, see, like, I have some sexual insecurities, and this mends me, and I feel comfortable sharing this. Like, I grew up, like, I went to the penitentiary the first time a virgin. Like, I didn't have sex until I was 21 years old. I wet the bed till I was 15 years old. And so, like, I was really insecure around all that stuff. And so even after being out for a few years and prostituting off my morals and beliefs in between prison sentences, you know, saying from 2001 to 2008, and engaging in all these shady sexual relationships with, you know, random chicks or whatever the case may be, I still was very sexually insecure. And when I didn't have a substance to change the way I felt and make me, you know what I'm saying, a bigger man than I thought I was, like, I couldn't even engage with women. I was shook the F up, man. Like, bad. But my friend, Sean, he had been to Narcotics Anonymous before me, before we went to prison. And he said, Joel, let's give another shot on Friday night. I said, all right, cool, man. So we go back to the dance. I'm in there. And I felt like the skirts were shorter. There was more females. And I'm like, okay. So I go out on the dance floor, man. I tried to put on that facade. You know what I mean? Like, I'm going to be that, like, you know, cool Modi guy, whatever. And I roll out there. And so I'm dancing a little bit, and I can't dance, man. Like, I wanted to be a black gangster rapper, but, you know what I'm saying, I wasn't none of that stuff. Like, I couldn't dance, and I don't got no dance moves or nothing. But I'm out there feeling it up, and this girl comes up behind me. She starts grinding on me. So I'm grinding on her real quick, And something came over me, and it just like, I didn't feel comfortable in that moment, and not because like I was sexually insecure, but more so because like I didn't want to participate in that stuff. Like I got to be honest with you, like when that moment happened, I realized that that wasn't living congruently with what God had in store for me. Like I didn't go there to shake my ass with some chicks. I went there to get connected with the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous, and I bailed out of the dance and I started going to some meetings and some workshops, and I started to, you know, I left my friend Sean there and he picked up on some newcomer and they went and did their thing, but I went and got connected to the Fellowship. And I started taking pictures with a bunch of members. And I started, you know, saying, getting connected with some people. And I started connecting with some newcomers. And I started getting what you guys had to offer me. And I'm thankful that I...
We lost the sound.
Yeah.
Can you speak up a little louder?
Yeah. Our diversity is our strength. We even got a mic guy in the Fellowship. Yeah. Oh. So we're. Oh yeah, I know where I was at. So I left the dance and I wanted to go Fellowship and I wanted to get connected and I wanted to like feel what you guys had to offer. And I went to all these workshops and I heard all these people carrying this message, the life-saving message, and I knew that I was where I was supposed to be at. And so when I left that convention, I was on fire for Narcotics Anonymous. I left there with that, and I went back to my little area in Southwest Washington, and I became that guy. 3 years clean, fresh out of the penitentiary, quoting the literature, talking about we need to do this and we need to do that, and they're doing this in Australia, they're doing this in Iran, they're doing this in SoCal. You know, SoCal is where Narcotics Anonymous is founded. This is what they're doing down there. And did it. And I was, you know, pontificating all this amazing stuff. And the Fellowship back home was like, hold on, homeboy. You're fresh out of the penitentiary. You're kind of a newcomer. Sit down and just listen. But I didn't really care, man. I heard guys say, oh, you know, years 3 to 10 is the hardest years. You know, you better stay gay. They were talking all this crazy stuff. We'll see how long you stay clean. I said, okay, cool, man. Like I allowed some of that healthy ego to fire me up. And I took that as a challenge because I was aware of what was happening around me. I was aware of those who were coming in and talking this game and not living it. You know, and the literature spoke to me. And it said in our 12 step that our message is meaningless unless we're living it. And I thought, well, shit. Like I don't want a meaningless message, so I better live this thing. So I started living it, even in the face of like people falling around, you know, down around me. Like there was guys who I got close with who died from this disease. My friend Mike, man, I invested so much love and hope into him, and I shared my entire life with him. We'd go to the gym every morning, and we'd talk about stuff, and I'd share how I was struggling in this area and struggling in that area, and I felt really comfortable with him because my first 4-step with my first sponsor, like that courage I had with that man, and he didn't judge me, gave me the ability to open up to other men, you know, saying there's something about like stepping out in faith and sharing my deepest, darkest secrets with another man that opened me up to be able to share my life with you guys. Like, I can't believe that I just told you guys I wet the bed till I was 14, 15 years old. Like that, you know what I'm saying? I believe it now, but that wasn't something that was a reality before. I don't want to tell nobody I didn't have sex till I was 21. I was the guy in the penitentiary making up all sorts of amazing stories about all these girls I slept with, and I didn't sleep with none of them. You know what I mean? That was me. I was so embarrassed to really tell you who I really was. But like Narcotics Anonymous and the 12 steps and being able to expose myself to another man gave me the ability to do that. And so I shared my heart with Mike. And Mike quit doing what we do here. Mike used. And he called me one day and he's like all jammed up. And I said, Mike, I'm at work, man. I've been going back and forth with him for a lot of days. I took him to a lot of meetings. Gave him a lot of white key tags after he relapsed. And he called me one day and I said, Mike, man, I'm at work. I can't come rescue you again. And I got off work and they said, Joel, you got to come. He's barricaded in the house. And I got to the house. I mean, it was too late. Mike threw a sheet over the door and hung himself, man, with his wife and his two kids outside. Death by the disease of addiction. And I watched him come off the balcony on the body bag. And I realized that like 3 through 10 is tough. But 1 through 50 is tough too. Like the disease wants us dead. And the disease will do whatever it can to interfere on this beautiful way of life that we have, you know, available to us. So Mike's death just, you know, motivated me more, and I knew that I got to stay on track because the disease wants to separate me from everything that's good in my life. Everything. And, 2012, man, my mom got sick. And that was my one reservation, my first step. I got my first step, and I read it, and I read it regularly. And my one reservation was that if my mom died or my dad died, I was going to use. But by the time 2012 came, I had a few years clean, and I worked a few steps, and I didn't have no more reservations. Like, I was committed. That convention had me committed in Narcotics Anonymous. The love you showed me had me committed in Narcotics Anonymous. And when she got sick, it wasn't about using. It was about reaching out and picking up the phone and saying, hey, Bart, how'd you stay clean through that? You know, Tommy, how'd you stay clean through that? And I was immersed myself in the middle of the fellowship, and you guys loved me through it. And so I showed up, and I got to practice that living direct amends to my mom until the day she died. And I shaved her hair for her when it was falling out. And I went to all those radiation appointments, and I went to the chemo appointments. And when she wanted to decorate for Christmas, I helped her decorate. And on January 25th of 2013, when she passed away, I was there bedside. Grateful that I was there and clean. Like, I always, you know what I'm saying, I was the type of guy who would have been in the trap house feeling sorry for myself, in the prison cell feeling sorry for myself, but Narcotics Anonymous and not using no matter what has given me the opportunity to show up today, even in the face of adversity. And I got to be the rock that held my family together through all that stuff. And I was just overwhelmed with gratitude. And that might sound wild to some people. Like, I share that sometimes as the newcomers are shook up. Like, how could you be grateful when your mother passes away? Well, you know what? When you stay clean long enough, you find gratitude in everything. Like, if I want to, I can look at the 20% of my life that may be challenging or the 20% of a situation that sucks. But there's 80% of things going on here that are beautiful. And I can gravitate and grab on those moments and stay connected with what God has in store for me if I choose to. And I was able to do that in those moments. And it just, you know, as I stay clean through these different challenges, the things that you'll, you know what I'm saying, more experienced and older members share with me just started to really ring true, you know. It talks about that, those who have came before me have paved the way, and I really connect with that. And I'm so thankful for all of you who have overcome challenges of, like, you know what I'm saying, starting home groups and developing our literature and you know, fellowship development, all that stuff. Because, like, I don't have to do any of that stuff. I just got to show up and participate and be of service. You know, like, I can learn from your guys' mistakes and your guys' struggles and grow from those. And so, like, I've surrounded myself with more experienced members. And there's that cliche that you want to follow the taillights of those who came before you. There's a lot of truth to that. There is, man. But I like to jump in the vehicle of those who have came before me. Like, if I'm hanging out with some more experienced members, it's easier for me to be like, hey, Dougie, what's up, man? Like, hey, you know, how do I do this? You know, I got my friend Dan T, man. Like, I'm in the vehicle with Dan because Dan's got what I want. And when I'm struggling, he's right there. He's like right next door. Hey, Dan, what's up, man? He's in the vehicle with me. I don't got to, like, chase him down and hunt him down and find his number. Like, I got him on speed dial. And I surround myself with solid members of Narcotics Anonymous who are living this way of life that are Narcotics Anonymous warriors, because I need that in my life. And when they're in the vehicle with me and I'm struggling, man, to drive the car, I'm like, hey, man, Dan, hop in the driver's seat. Drive for me today. I can't, man. Like, and there's been moments in my life, in my recovery, where I haven't been able to drive the car. Like, I'll be honest with you, like, I've been so overwhelmed and consumed with anxiety and fear of just life in general that I've wanted to curl up in a ball and die. Like, I've wanted to go back to the penitentiary where it's easier. Like I found myself, like, not wanting to use, but thinking using's appealing. Thinking that, you know what I'm saying, a couple of shots of Jack Daniels and going to hang out at the bar with some people and whatever, it could, you know what I'm saying, could produce some a good time in my life. And the reality of it is, man, that those thoughts will come and they're fleeting these days. And when that stuff happens, like, I got somebody in the vehicle that I can reach out to and talk to about that. And I'm thankful for that. And so I can humble myself on a regular basis now. And it's easier because going back to that first four step and going back to you know what I'm saying, being courageous and sharing intimately with another man. Because, see, I thought intimacy was about sex. You guys told me, no, Joel, intimacy is not about sex. It's about sharing your heart with another person, another individual. And so I've done that here, and I share my heart and my life with others. And so when I'm struggling, they're there for me. And I've struggled. Like, I've struggled mightily throughout my recovery. And I've got this, like, you know, I've always been ambitious, and I've always wanted to achieve things, and I've always wanted to, you know what I'm saying, do those things that I always wanted to do when I was young. You know, and so I started back on this education endeavor. And It's been challenging. For the last 8 years, I've been in school in some way, shape, or form or another. And in 19 days, I graduated with my master's degree. First person in my entire family to ever graduate with a master's degree. I'm the hope to die dopey, man. Two trips to the penitentiary, 9-time convicted felon. Robbed everything that, my parents ever had from them. And through this beautiful way of life, through the 12 steps in our cosmos, you guys, I've been given that back day after day after day after day, the longer I stay clean. So I know that the things that I'm doing now are honoring my family. I've been able to honor my mom, because my mom was my biggest enabler. Like, she was always sending the care packages. She'd always show up for all the visits. And she always knew that, there was something inside of me that I didn't even know was there. And she'd tell me all the time, Joel, today can be the first day of the rest of your life. And I would always say, I'll start tomorrow. Huh? I'll start tomorrow, Mom. But that one day back in July 2008, man, I chose that day. And since then, I've been honoring her. And day after day, I've just, one day at a time, I've continued to put one foot in front of the other. And I've been able to, create this beautiful life for myself. Beautiful life. And in active addiction, guys, I don't know if you guys can identify this, but you'd be like 1 foot forwards and 7 or 8 steps back. 2 steps forwards, 7 or 8 steps back. You might put 3 steps forward together and hang out, for a little bit of time. But before too long, man, getting and finding ways and means to get more would send me backwards. And in recovery, it's 3-4 steps forwards, and I'll take a couple back. I'll take a hit. And I'll fall backwards. Life will show up and boom, knock me off my feet. But I'll get back up, and you guys will pull me back up, and I'll keep moving forward. And that's kind of how life has been over the last, 12 years. When I got out, I had this vision that I was going to reconnect with my daughter right away. Right away. Instant gratification, right? And I'd go to this meeting that there was a lot of mothers who were in this program that would bring their kids there. They'd go to this program for 30 days, and 30 days later, they get their kids back in their life. And I'd go there, and I was resentful. It made me angry because they were getting their kids back so fast. But I kept going, and one day my sponsor said, Joel, why don't you quit being resentful when you go there, and go there and find hope? I said, okay. And so I kept going, and I kept working steps, and I kept, practicing the 11th step. And I was praying for knowledge of God's will and the power to carry it out. Over and over and over again, just waiting for God to present the opportunity for me to be a father again. And I kept going to that meeting year after year after year. And one day, Jolie and I were heading out of town to go to an event, and we stopped at the bra and panty store, and we were shopping for her, fellas, not me. And I was shopping up with the lady at the front counter, and she said, she started talking to me about all sorts of stuff, and I told her we just got back from the World Convention in Philadelphia, and we're on our way to Las Vegas for Valentine's Day, and she asked me if I had any kids. And I said, yeah, I have a daughter that I haven't had a relationship with since she was a year and a half. And she said, so you're flying all over the country, spending all this fucking money, you're not being a part of your daughter's life, what kind of fucking dad are you? And I said, whoa. And I've been praying for knowledge of God's will and the power to carry it out, folks. And God presented himself that day in the bra and panty store from that lady. And God has showed up in a variety of different ways. But when God shows up and speaks to me, I hear it. And I called my sponsor up, and my sponsor said, hey, it's time. And so I stepped out in faith, and I started to do the work that we need to do here to restore the relationships that we pissed away in active addiction. And my daughter's the one that, I chose that little sack of dope over her. And no longer was it easy to, hide behind the fact that she wasn't, that I couldn't find her mom, but because God had showed up and God said, hey, Joel, it's time. And so we did some research, and we found her mom in Arizona. And I hired an attorney, and I jumped through all these hoops, and I was caught in the disease of separation, where it's saying, Joel, you're not worthy of being a father. Those things you've done in the past, all these felonies and the abuse, the way you abused her mom and the way you neglected her is going to interfere with your ability to be a part of her life. The disease was telling me that. Don't spend another $3,000, Joel. It's not worth it. But my sponsor said, Joel, it's worth it. My wife picked up another job, and we kept putting in the money. And 2 years later, one day I showed up in court, over the phone. The judge said, we're not concerned about what Joel used to be like. He's a good man today. He's worthy of being a father. And in March of that year, I flew down here and seen my daughter for the first time, and I got to give her this hug, man. She tried to pull away, and I snatched her ass back up, gave one of those NA hugs, pulled her in real tight. There's only one promise here, right? Freedom from active addiction. But the longer I've stayed clean, I've got to experience the gifts. And that restoring that relationship with my daughter is one of those gifts. And it's been the most challenging thing that I've been through in my recovery. Like, I wanted to be a dad, but I have no clue how to be a dad. Not one clue whatsoever. Like, I was a guy who imposed my will on women, and I would act like I was some kid's dad, you know what I'm saying, while I was in the bathroom smoking dope. And I would buy them things and do whatever to act like some sort of father figure, but I was never really a dad. And so all of a sudden I got this girl in my life, a little girl that I get part-time. We moved down here to be closer to her, and now she's like coming over on the weekends, and I'm like feeling this thing out, and I became Disneyland dad, and that didn't work. When I do all this really cool stuff for her, and one time I was going to speak at this event, and she got mad at me the weekend before because she couldn't go play with her friends, and she said, "Dad, I don't like Narcotics Anonymous. I don't like you, and I think you used me to make your Narcotics Anonymous story cooler." And I thought, "Damn, whew, shook me up, right?" But see, like my sponsor always says, man, Joel, when you're serving God's will and you're doing the next right thing, God will use anything possible to get at you. And sometimes a 12-year-old girl is a good way to get at you at. You know, and so the disease will work through whatever way means possible to get at you. And was trying to do that that day with my daughter. But I was able to apply these steps to that situation and practice some acceptance and know that, hey, you know what? Like, I'm not that guy no more. I may have did those things. And I may have abandoned her at some point in time, but I'm not that guy anymore. And I embraced what she had to say, and I allowed her to share, and she yelled and she screamed, and by the time it was all said and done, we were crying, and we were loving on each other, and it was an opportunity for her to vent and get that stuff out, because I wanted to see all sorts of stuff, like get out of my house and do it, but that stuff, you know, that's not a solution, and I was able to love her through that, and we've been on this journey, you know what I'm saying, she's about to turn 14 years old, and last night we sat at the poolside, man, she's got a mother who I'm not super fond of. But I practice these principles with her, and I don't appreciate the way that she parents my daughter. But that's her thing. I just do what I can do. And my daughter's she struggles with eating, and her mom always imposes these beliefs about how she should be eating, how she should be taking care of herself, and it's killing my daughter inside. It's emotionally destroying what's going on in her life. And she has a lot of self-confidence, and she's okay with who she is, but her mom keeps beating her down. And last night we were in the hot tub, and she was sharing like just her heart with us, and I was just taking all in, and I was loving on her, and I work in the field, man. Like, I'm like, come sit on my couch and tell me how you feel. Like, I'm a therapist, right? But I can't fix my own daughter. Like, I can't help her, you know what I mean? And it hurts me so bad because she shares this stuff with me, but I can't, like, can't fix her. I gotta show up as a dad, and I want her to go get help, but her mom just interferes with all this stuff, so I gotta leave it up to God. Like, I'm powerless. I'm just completely powerless, and I gotta turn it over to my higher power, and I gotta believe that if she doesn't believe in my higher power, that she's got one herself. And so I just leave it up to God, and she shares all this stuff with us, and she's crying, and we go back. And 11:55 last night, we get a call from the Tolleson Police Department. It says, my wife says, Jolene, do you own a blue Kona? And she's like, yeah. And she said, well, we got it. It's pulled over here on 91st Avenue in Van Buren. And your daughter and her friend are in it, driving, 14 and 15 years old. She was so jammed up that, like, she just wanted to act out, and she took off in our car. I'm like, fuck, man. Like, shook me up, man. And so her friend was supposed to come with us today, and instantly, like, I get jammed up, you know, since she's destroying my plans, and why is she doing this? And then I get to this level of empathy, because I remember when I was that 13-year-old kid who was insecure, and I didn't like the way I felt inside, and people, you know, I was getting bullied at school, and I wanted to act out, and that's what I was doing, you know, at that age. Like, I was acting out, and I was using, and I was imposing will on people because I didn't like the way I felt, and so I empathized with her. And we went and picked her up, and my wife didn't want her to ride in the car with her because my wife's a little bit more, you know, she's not as quite as spiritual as I am. And the first thing I said when I got in the car was that I love you. I love you no matter what. And she started crying, and she shared her process with me about why she did the things that she did. And she knew it wasn't right as soon as she got pulled over when the lights were behind her. And I could identify with that. Like, it was always okay until the lights were on behind me, every time. And I shared that with her. And it was like, and she's here with us today, guys. And she loves Narcotics Anonymous. She really does. Even though she said that one, she loves it because she knows what it does for us and my wife. And I got this beautiful wife in my life who it's not everybody's story that you know what I'm saying, you get to experience this NA boy meets NA girl and runs off to Nirvana, or NA boy meets NA boy and runs off to Nirvana, or NA girl meets NA girl and runs off to Nirvana. That's not everybody's story, but it's mine, right? And I got this beautiful woman of recovery in my life that has showed me things that, like, just blow my mind. Her level of selflessness to be there for my daughter and for my family is just remarkable. And so I'm gonna share this God story, and then I'm gonna wrap it up. A year and a half ago, 2 years ago, my wife comes home one day and says, "Hey, I want to give away a kidney." And I thought, okay. And so a couple weeks go by, and she said, "I keep seeing on the back of cars, like, my husband needs a kidney, my wife needs a kidney, my kid needs a kidney. I need to give away my kidney." I'm like, okay, like, you know, what do you want to do? Like, you want to put on social media or something? I don't know, you know. She's like, no. Let's pray about it. So we literally prayed, "God, if it's meant to be, just show us your will. I'm not kidding you." We went to the Day of the Dinosaurs event in the valley that same night. And Jolene's talking to a couple friends about this. And this guy walks over and says, "Are you serious? Because I know a guy who needs a kidney." And then all of a sudden, I'm like, get self-centered. I'm like, holy shit, this might really happen. Like, I don't know, my wife's going to be away in Oregon. She might die. Like, I need her. Like, can't pay the bills without her. I don't want to find another wife. All this self-centered stuff. Because honestly, guys, like, I wish I could tell you that the first thing I think about in the morning is not myself, but that's not the case. Like, I think about myself first thing every morning. So I'm a little bit, you know, jammed up. And I think, oh, this won't really happen. So she gets the guy's number, and she calls the guy up, right, and leaves a message and says, "Hey, so I hear you're looking for a kidney. I got two. I'm willing to give you one." And I'm like, okay, the guy doesn't call back, right? So a month goes by, and we see the guy who was the middleman. You know, there's always a middleman, you know? And he says, she goes, "Hey, I haven't heard back from your buddy yet." And she's like, "He can't just call you and ask for an organ. Like, you got to reach out to him, you know?" And I didn't. So I guess you just can't call people and ask for organs. But so she calls him, and he answers, right? And so they start the process, and they go out, and the blood type works. They do this infusion thing. They mix the blood, and that works. And they go do some more tests, and that works. And then she's super healthy, right? And I'm like, holy shit, this is really going to happen. And I start to get self-centered. I'm like jammed up, but I just show up, you know, do the best I can. And she goes through some more tests, and we had this all planned. We had a convention at the end of May, so she's going to donate the kidney on May 7th, which is going to be healed up. We're going to be at the convention at the end of May in Arkansas. We're going to go to another convention in June, and Sacramento in June, where all those things lined up. And she had one, it held her up real quick, right? So we couldn't move forward. And so then I'm like pissed now, because my conventions are going to be in jeopardy. I'm not going to be able to go do this and that. So things get delayed, and all of a sudden they're like, "Call me, like, you're clear to donate." So she calls the guy up. June 13th, and she says, "Hey, are you available on June 28th? And he's like, "Yeah, I am." And she goes, "Well, that's a date." Like, he goes, "Man, that's beautiful, because that's my 11-year clean date." So my wife donated a kidney to this cat on his 11-year clean date, and we gave him a coin in the pre-op room, and we were fellowshipping it up, man. And they're both healthy as all outdoors now. And me and Scott, he was Scott Kidney for a long time in her phone, you know, Scott Kidney. Now he's just Scott. And Scott and I go golfing, and it's kind of wild. I was watching him tee off one time, and I was like, "It's my wife's kidney in there." But it's his kidney now, like, you know, whatever. But I share that story for those of you that may be thinking that, like, man, miracles don't happen in our cosmos. You might not have bought all into this thing yet, man. But if you stay here long enough, miracles will happen. And if we just continue to experience the gift of the freedom from active addiction, that, you know, that one promise, and we'll get to experience the gifts. And so I keep coming because I want to experience the miracles and the gifts. And we're all miracles right now. Like, I know I'm a miracle, and I know that, like, life is going to show up ahead of me, and I'm going to get old one day, and I'm going to have to deal with, you know what I'm saying, medication and surgery and all that stuff. But so thank you guys who have came before me and shared about that stuff, because I need that experience, because I'm not alone if I'm with you guys, and I can draw from your experience. And so thank you for your vulnerability and your transparency to come in and share about that, because, like, it gives me the ability to come in and share about struggling with anxiety and struggling with fear. And I know that I'm not alone. And so just for today, I'm going to be unafraid. My thoughts are going to be on my new associations, people who are not using how to, and found a new way to live. And as long as I follow that way, I have nothing to fear. I'm Joel Nack. That's all I got.
Let's give Joel another round.